There's the big board, the 20 electoral votes from the state of Pennsylvania. We just got new metrics in.
The inauguration of a president celebrates a peaceful transition of power engineered by the American voters.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome, listeners of the 45th podcast. Rabia Chaudhry here, and I'm here with my co-host, Susan Simpson. Hey, Susan.
Hey, Rabia. And we are here for the 45th episode of the 45th podcast.
The 45th episode. I mean, he's still hanging in there.
He is. He did not, like, arrange for a grand finale for the 45th episode, like I hope, but...
It wasn't too bad. There's a lot of big news this week.
And full disclosure, you may notice that we're dropping this today on Wednesday instead of Tuesday, like normal. And there may have been a slight snafu at some point. In the recording process. But luckily for you, it means you have new updates on what happened today, Tuesday.
The latest. We're going to bring the very latest to you. It's totally my fault. My machine sucks. And I am making Susan do all this work all over again. We literally recorded the entire episode and we're starting all over again. But that's okay. That's okay. Anything for our listeners.
You knew that Mueller had more indictments waiting for us.
That's right. He did. He had some more stuff, some more juice, and it's all connected, which is making it even more interesting. But to be honest, I was hoping by now we would have moved on to the 46th podcast, but I guess we're still here. He's still around. Trump is still around. We're going to start off with the most terrible news that came out of last week, and that was on February 14th, Valentine's Day. The day didn't start off with this news. It began with more disclosures on Trump's affair.
Affairs. Valentine's Day began with some more thematic breaking news.
Thematic.
We found out that Michael Cohen, so there's kind of confusion here because what we found at first was the New York Times story, which reported that Michael Cohen had paid Stormy Daniels, I think their phrasing was, out of his own pocket.
And that's Trump's personal family attorney, by the way.
The Trump organization. Of course, looking at his actual quote from Michael Cohen, he didn't say he personally paid Stormy Daniels. He said that he facilitated a payment to Stormy Daniels, which is lawyer talk for I'm being a weasel. So we don't know exactly what happened there. My guess is he probably paid to arrange for the payment of the $130,000. But if he did pay himself, that doesn't really help matters because he's kind of just admitted to a federal Election Commission Act violation.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a crime. But if he facilitated the payment, I don't think it helps the president any. I mean, either way, although maybe I guess that's not the scandal anymore, right? It's like it's not the actual... It's how he covered it up. That's shocking people. But either way, it's not a good look. They're admitting they paid off a porn star. So,
and the confusion helps him for now. But it's not going to help him for that long because we already know there's an ongoing FEC investigation into him, which is why he gave the statement in the first place. So this is being pursued. It's being investigated. He has to give real answers at some point, not publicly.
Just to refresh our listeners, because you're the one, because you had looked up like the payments online and you had traced some of it. Exactly what was it that's funny about these payments? It's because it looks like they came from the campaign itself.
So to clarify it, this is speculation on my part, and I have no way of confirming it. I would love if some journalist out there would follow it up and get an answer on the record from the Trump campaign. But what stands out to me is that on the day that the second LLC was made, to arrange for the payment to Stormy Daniels, there was the first of a series of transfers that were unusually large. There had been no transfers of that size prior in the campaign to Trump-owned entities, Trump hotels, Las Vegas, D.C. And if you add up the amounts for the starting on the 17th of October and then following up with the last payment on the 24th or 5th, I believe, their total is like $129,000. $990 and like some change, 84 cents.
So Cohen just paid that last buck out of his own pocket.
He paid the 24 cents. That's how he facilitated the payment. And, you know, it could be a coincidence. Math is weird. Sometimes that kind of happens. But to me, it does stand out and demands an explanation of some sort.
Those are fake payments. They had
Maybe
to cover.
Not, but it's strange. And it's, again, it could be for real campaign expenses. A few days later, there was a event out in Las Vegas, where one of the larger payments was going. But this was before the event, and from his campaign disclosures, he didn't seem to prepay his entities. So it's strange if that was actually, in fact, for a real event. It's at least anomalous in that regard. So yeah, hopefully someone will follow up on it, and I could explain what's going on here, too, though, because...
Is that what the FEC is investigating, though? Part of what the FEC...
No. Okay. Well, I hope so. But so what might have happened here is that they knew they couldn't have someone else pay for it, because that's a campaign violation. The campaign could pay for that kind of thing, but they have to make it publicly disclosed. So maybe they use campaign funds and just happen to route it through Trump-owned entities and then routed it to the LLC that Cohen created and then routed it to Stormy Daniels. And they'll try and claim it's not a violation because they disclosed the steps they had to disclose and didn't disclose. Who knows? So that's just, again, pure speculation. I have no proof other than the fact that the numbers are weird and line up with what we know.
Well, I'm going all in. I think that's what happened.
Well, what we do know now is that Trump has a routine in place for how he pays off people with dirt on him. In fact, there's an attorney out in California who regularly works, not works with, I guess they're opposing sides technically, but regularly has cases opposite the Trump Organization and Cohen where someone has dirt on Trump. They retain him as their attorney. He talks to Cohen. Cohen arranges for a payment. The attorney is paid. The client gets paid. Info never comes out.
Isn't this like blackmail? I mean, I feel like this is like a legally negotiated blackmail process in a way.
Are you suggesting Trump could be compromised by his bad behavior in the past? I mean,
you know what? Honestly, I thought so. I don't think so anymore. I feel like the Russians could literally release the pee-pee tapes and people are like, all right, okay, so he likes to be peed on. What's wrong with that? And we would move on. I feel like nothing can compromise this asshole. I could be wrong.
It's one of the cases, though. It's absolutely the case. For Trump especially, that it's not the crime, it's the cover-up.
Yeah. All right, so the day that this news came out, again, the morning of February 14th, there were going to be a press conference. Obviously, the White House was going to do their daily briefing thingy. It was getting delayed, and then some terrible news emerged, and it gave them a pretext not to have their briefing, but also, obviously, it made the entire nation pay attention, and that is the shooting in Parkland, Florida, where a ex-student returned to a high school, killed 17 people. He had an AR-15, which I think he had turned into a fully automatic weapon. He had many, many magazines on him. He was taken into custody, completely safe and perfectly fine. He had managed to just walk away from the school, having dropped his gear and stuff. And apparently, Susan, you had mentioned last time we recorded that he was found purchasing some juice or something somewhere.
After the shooting, he went and apparently bought like a drink at like Subway or something and then was heading back towards the house he was staying at when they apprehended him. It is a bit unusual, I think. I don't know the stats on this, but I found it strange that he didn't attempt to kill himself, which seems to be fairly normal.
Right.
God, I hate there's a normal in this, but that does seem to be the pattern. And he doesn't seem to have any inclination he wanted to hurt himself.
Right. There's actually no indication even from like his social media posts or any other thing. This kid had a lot of issues. He definitely has behavioral problems. He has emotional issues. There's a reason he was expelled from the school.
Is that code for he's white?
I don't think so. I think it's beyond being white.
I meant that instead of being like a monster.
Exactly. Instead of being like ideologically inclined towards violence or ethnically inclined towards violence. No, he definitely had problems. And, you know, the thing about this is like, this is one of those cases in which the school, the authorities, I think, took almost every step possible. You know, he had lost both of his parents, and I know that he was adopted to begin with, I think, and then he had lost his adopted mother as well last November. He was living with, you know, some friends, like their family and stuff, and he was certainly in a very dark, lonely place, but the school, over and over again, you know, took notice of his behavior, made sure he didn't return to school. He had posted really dangerous stuff online. The FBI were alerted. They looked into it. You know, and he had bought these weapons legally. And so this is like obviously every time this happens over and over again, it's the same conversation, just the same rage erupts. And it's the same bullshit response from the GOP, which is, well,
Thoughts and prayers.
Thoughts and prayers. And also, what can you do? And, you know, and Trump, obviously, I mean, like one of the first things he tweeted about, like, you know, when he tweeted about this a number of times, he said, so many signs a Florida shooter was mentally disturbed, even expelled from school for bad and erratic behavior. Neighbors and classmates knew he was a big problem, must always report such instances to authorities again and again. Of course, suggesting that it was their fault for not doing so, but also being wrong because they did do so. And saying it was a mental disturbance issue when we know that was not the issue here.
Yeah. And there is one side sort of story to all this that's worth pointing out. So we do know that the shooter expressed violently racist beliefs against all variety of people, domestic violence in his background, of course. And we know that in his pictures on, social media, Instagram, one of them, he was wearing a Make America Great Again hat. But there was initially sort of the day after reporting that he had trained with white supremacist groups. But it turns out that no, white supremacist groups are just taking a play out of the terrorist playbook and claiming credit for attacks they didn't do to increase their notoriety and increase their reach, which is not a phenomenon we've experienced that much here. So people kind of incredulously just took the story.
It is incredible. I mean, it's incredible because, you know, ISIS will take credit for like anything they can.
So ISIS, I was reading, only because we're reading about this, ISIS actually is one of the more careful groups about what they'll claim. They often, in fact, underclaim what they did. They're known for being very diligent in claiming only their actual, whatever, however they define it, attacks. But a lot of other terrorist groups are not so discerning.
I mean, I guess it depends on where you draw that line. I mean, if somebody's never been in touch with, like, ISIS or never been overseas, but they're ISIS-inspired, you know, I've seen cases where this will say, yeah. But the point is, that was a really weird twist that took place where you have this group saying, oh, yeah, he was one of us, and then and turned out to be a hoax. I mean, who does that? I feel like... Do they not know that might get them in legal trouble too? Or I don't know. Anyway.
Get some attention, which is what they really want.
Get some attention. Well, you know, Trump responded, as a president should, issuing a proclamation, giving a really heartfelt, inauthentic press conference. And it just,
but didn't mention guns once.
Yeah, a bunch of bullshit. His proclamation was basically, we're going to lower flags to half staff for 4 days, and that's how we're going to fix it. Since then, him and Melania did go down to Florida. They took some absolutely ridiculous pictures with his thumbs up, big flashy smile in the hospital next to kids who had been almost murdered. And then he partied at Mar-a-Lago for a couple of days. So another tweet, and this a couple of different things I've been trying to do in terms of deflecting what happened is... what's happening in the right is that they are trying to blame the FBI for missing the signs here. And Trump tweeted, very sad the FBI missed all the many signals sent up by the Florida school shooter. It's not acceptable. They're spending too much time trying to prove Russian collusion with the Trump campaign. There is no collusion. Get back to the basics and make us all proud.
I know it's a high bar, but this is a very strong candidate for one of his top 10 grossest tweets of all time.
Of all time. Not just since his presidency, huh? It's pretty reprehensible. Yeah.
He's undermining the FBI, blaming children's death. He's blaming the FBI for children dying because they were investigating him instead. Like, one, it's factually ridiculous. But even aside from that, it's horrible. Like,
it is making it about himself again, too.
Again.
He is the ultimate victim here, not the kids who were killed. He is the victim here. But the interesting thing is, and so a couple of thoughts that I had about this. Number one, and we had a great conversation about this yesterday, but let's do this again. I don't know what more the FBI could have done. The big problem here is that the kid bought these guns illegally. These were not illegal weapons. There's not a lot you can do, a law enforcement officer can do in a situation where somebody hasn't broken the law. And then you can't keep somebody trained on them, following them 24 hours a day until they do break the law. That's just not how things work. So there, it feels like every measure was taken. And so then the issue is, why are these kinds of weapons legal? Why are they necessary? And that's really the core of this debate, is what do we allow people to have? I just read this morning, some church, I think in Texas, is going to do a blessing. It's actually going to hold like some kind of a blessing of weapons. And so they're telling their parishioners to bring their weapons and they're going to bless the weapons. I don't understand what's happening here. But we have an obsession in this country with weapons and a deification almost of weapons. That's just ridiculous.
It's a hobby. Let's be real. It's a hobby. Guns are fun. I got nothing against, like, I don't think I have shot guns before and I love doing it, but it's a fucking hobby. It is not a lifestyle. It's not an identity. It's not the core of anyone's existence, which is what they have turned it into. And they have internalized it to believe that a threat to their guns is in fact a threat to them.
Who's a them? I'm really trying to figure out what, you know, I understand, like, okay, there's the Constitution, right? But I also understand it was a different time. and it was, there were different weapons, and it was, I mean, like, at this point, I don't care what your arsenal looks like. You're not going to defeat the government if they show up at your door, okay, with this. This is not going to happen. So what is at the core of this, Susan, this love of guns in this country? I really don't get it.
I'm sure there's some great papers on it. I'm purely speculating, but it's, I think it's a,
I've never held a gun.
It's an equating of, like, your manhood to your ability to kill people.
Well, that's disturbing.
That's my entirely unscientific Freudian take on it. And again, like, people, like, a lot of people just like guns because they're fun and hobbies and whatever, and they want to, like, protect their rights to do that. But it's far beyond that. It's definitely some sort of cultural identity that's, it's, and of course the NRA is made a whole industry on making gun ownership an identity so they can sell more guns and make more money.
Right. So yeah, of course, the lobby here is very, very important. To, you know, they're a big part of it. So Susan, you and I, a lot of our work is in front of a phone or a computer, but it's not just us, because nowadays, no matter what kind of work you do, chances are you're staring at your phone or computer a lot. And our eyes were not made to stare at screens all day, and you end up getting dryness, migraines, blurry vision. It's just a few of the reasons you need to protect your eyes. And now you can do that and look great at the same time with a pair of computer glasses from Felix Gray.
Felix Gray's glasses are designed specially so the lenses filter out blue light and eliminate glare from screens, which is the two main culprits behind digital eye strain.
And the blue light filtering technology, it's actually embedded into the lens, so it's like they work without having this funky yellow tint or color distortion, and they look nice that way too.
Yeah, and it's, of course, not just work where we're looking at screens all day. Let's be real, you're doing it for fun too, and late at night. So you want to avoid the headaches, avoid the glare, try Felix Gray's frames. They look good too.
They're gorgeous. They are handcrafted from premium Italian acetate. It's the same stuff that Versace uses, and they have lots of beautiful styles.
All orders are free shipping and free returns, so you've got nothing to lose, except for annoying eye strain.
So give your eyes the break they deserve. Go to felixgrayglasses.com/45th to try a pair of Felix Gray computer glasses and discover a smarter way to work. That's felixgrayglasses.com/45th. felixgrayglasses.com/45th. The other thing I was going to say about the FBI, you know, in the past, you know, like with the Boston bombing, where I think they actually did drop the ball on that one, there was not a wholesale attack like this on the FBI. There weren't calls for resignations of the FBI director. And this time, it seems very much so that this is also related to the Russia, the response to, you know, this in terms of attacking the FBI is also coming from the right. And it seems to me like it has a lot to do with the Russian stuff too.
It fully is. And I'll say, as much as this has become, the whole mass shooting thing has become this horrible, tragic script in America, where, you know, we know what's going to happen. We know how it happens roughly. We know what it kind of looks like. We know it in advance. And we know what happens after. There's at least two big differences here. And one of them is that, yes, the FBI is being attacked. That's like the demon here is the FBI. And the other is that the children themselves are speaking out.
Yeah. Incredibly forcefully. I don't know if you saw the rally that was held a few days after the shooting. Emma Gonzalez, you know, a student at the school. I mean, she was just powerful, incredible. But even right immediately after the shooting, like literally that same afternoon, there were students on camera being incredibly articulate, like, you know, saying like, this is an issue, like, these are our lives that we take in. Like, we need our politicians to respond with more than thoughts and prayers. Now, what's really disgusting is, in the last, I think, 24 hours or so, there has been, or 48 hours, there's been, like, reporting coming out of Gateway Pundit, you know, these really right-wing outlets saying that these kids...
Which, by the way, has a White House credential.
Oh, right. They are part of the White House press corps. And I think Don Trump Jr. retweeted this story. And so they're, like, kind of fostering this idea that these young, these students are actually... plants.
They're attacking the kids who's speaking
out. They're attacking
out.
The kids. They're saying they're Democratic plants. They're saying that the one young man who spoke, his father's retired FBI, and so he said, made those talking points to, like, literally in the hours after the shooting, deflect from FBI culpability.
They had a picture of this kid, a high school student who survived being murdered while many of his classmates and teachers were murdered, and they put, like, a red, like, wording over it saying exposed, and the exposure is that his dad's a retired FBI agent. Like, that's, like, that's now, one, a slur and a character attack against this child, and two, this is what we do now after mass shootings, is attack the survivors.
You know, I really, really hope, instead of this being a story where people are outraged and then they move on, is that this fucking outlet is sued into the ground. They should be sued into, this is straight up defamation. I mean, I don't, it's beyond the pale. It is it's beyond gross. The pale. They would have to, their only defense would be the truth. They would have to prove the truth of their
I mean, the truth is that his father is a retired FBI agent.
Retired FBI agent, right. That means nothing. They should be sued. I mean, that's where I'm at. Yeah. I hope somebody decides to take that up and sue their asses off.
Here's a quote, but just to get an idea of the tenor of the conversation here, here's a quote on this the same kid. Quote, why would the child of an FBI agent be used as a pawn for anti-Trump rhetoric and anti-gun legislation? Because the FBI is only looking to curb your constitutional rights and increase their power. We've seen similar moves by them many God. Times over. This is just another disgusting example of it.
Is that from the article?
Yeah.
It's amazing. You know what's also amazing to me is that these people want to take on the fucking FBI. I would not want to take on the FBI. Because you know what? If the FBI does want to... Everybody's got some shit. They will find it. They will find it and they will take you down somehow.
Hopefully they won't, though, because that would be a massive abuse of powers that hopefully they've gotten past.
No, I don't mean an abuse of power. I mean everybody's probably got some shit that they've done that they shouldn't have done.
That's why people don't like the FBI, because they have a history of doing that that hopefully they no longer do.
If somebody broke the law somewhere, you know, they find it, I'm okay with that. As long as it was a real, real illegal act and not something trumped up. All right. I do agree with you that the response is different. There are planned marches that are going to happen, student-led marches, and also a walkout. And I've gotten a couple different dates on the walkout. I'm not sure which. I have heard April 20th. I've also heard March 14th. But obviously, we'll keep an eye on that and report. So student walkouts around the country are going to be taking place. There was a student die-in in front of the White House the other day. And, you know, one thing I remember... With Sandy Hook, I thought, oh, this will be the turning point. It wasn't. But of course, those are like babies. But these kids are, they are not just older, but a lot of them are very close to voting age. So, you know, maybe this will be finally what turns the tide on this issues. We'll see. Moving on. What else happened?
So just a few hours ago. So earlier we talked about the two, Karen McDougal and Stormy Daniels, the two women. One's a porn actress and one's a former playmate that Trump had affairs with, and he paid off or had friends pay off to keep them quiet. So that's been in the news too, and that's probably not going to go away anytime soon. But there's also today Trump himself revived a similar but different story about his record of women accusing him very credibly of sexual assault. And one of those women, there's a fantastic Washington Post article, you should read it, about her story and what she's doing and how she's decided that the only thing she can do is just keep telling her story and hope that someone listens. So she's been doing that. And it turns out that she was onto something because Donald Trump listened and tweeted about it today.
Oh, wait a minute. What are we talking about? I totally missed this.
This was like an hour ago. And so he tweeted out, a woman I don't know and to the best of my knowledge never met is on the front page of the fake news Washington Post saying I kissed her for 2 minutes yet in the lobby of Trump Tower 12 years ago. Never happened. Who would do this in a public space with live security cameras running? Another false accusation. And it goes on to like whatever rant about false news, fake, whatever the hell his like Carter Page wording is. And of course, the story was not about an incident in the lobby. She was a secretary for Bayrock. So on the 24th floor of Trump Tower in a private area. So either he didn't read the story, which is possible, but probably more likely he knows exactly what happened and is doing this false story about the lobby to try and detract it for whatever. I don't even know the plot there, like his like mad scheme, because it's stupid as heck. What he shouldn't have done is like mention it at all, because like this would assure attention to it. There have been so many stories and like they've gotten kind of ignored because they never go anywhere. Well, this was a huge boost to her story. And let's keep in mind, what she says happened in 2006. She says that, and she has phone records to prove it, she immediately called her sister after to talk to her about it. She then emailed her mother and her sister talking about the event and what happened to her in 2006. And then in 2016, when Trump's running for office, she came forward and told the New York Times about her story. So in order to believe that this is all made up, what you have to believe is that she decided one day randomly in 2006, while at her new job as a secretary for Bayrock, she decided she would just like tell her family this bullshit made up story about Trump assaulting her in a hallway and then do nothing about it for 12 years.
Yeah.
10 years, I guess, at the time.
Well, I mean, they're going to say that she actually didn't, or if she did, she made it up then, or her family is lying too, and they're all lying. They're all
coming together now. They have the emails, they have the phone records. She definitely, in 2006, communicated with her family about it. So it's a very unlikely scheme if it actually was a false accusation, like you're saying.
Once again, his base don't care, neither does the GOP, and that's our problem. So, oh, yeah, but it's been a very busy Twitter day today. He's using his executive time fully. I don't, it's like every hour there are like numerous tweets. I don't know how he does. It's a work day. It's a fucking work day. We're all working. Why does he not do his job? Why is he tweeting?
It's like last weekend when it rained and he couldn't golf and he just like shit posted all day.
Today's a nice day though.
Well, yeah, but this weekend he couldn't golf because they thought it'd look bad after the shooting, and he was only about a half hour away from the shooting down in Mar-a-Lago. So instead of golfing, he shitposted all day.
He did. He tweeted a lot. There was that, and there was also a reason for him to tweet. I mean, like, he was probably very, very upset at the indictments that were announced last Friday. Do we want to talk about that, or do we want to talk a little bit about stuff his cabinet members have been up to that we...
Recap. Everyone in Trump's cabinet has serious problems with ethics and corruption, and they keep flying on really expensive flights for no reason because they feel like they're entitled to it, and they cause scandals that are pretty horrific and yet mostly get ignored. The latest ones involve Shulkin, who's at the VA, and Pruitt, who's at the EPA. Shulkin's the worst one. He spent like tons of, like $100,000 on this trip to Europe for 10 days last year. Took his wife along, and his chief of staff got caught like falsifying emails that were changed to allege that the purpose of the trip was work related, and therefore could be paid for by the government. When really, like, his wife was like sending all these requests to the EPA, like officials, like, "Hey, I'd like to go visit like the baths in Italy or wherever they were doing
on her Wimbledon
European tour." Wimbledon. He also got tickets to see Wimbledon, and then lied about the fact he claimed he bought them himself. That was not true. Then claimed they were a gift from a friend, but his wife couldn't remember the friend's name. So as the report found, the evidence of friendship was thin. So, but he'll probably survive because Shulkin, unlike Price, who was at HHS and did get booted, is close to Trump. Mm-hmm. So Shulkin has that sort of relationship with Trump that might let him skate by despite the, like, in any other administration, he'd be already gone.
I mean, he's still got his job. I mean, it doesn't sound like he's going anywhere.
He's
and some of these
anywhere.
Expenses that that you reported, or at least you indicated in
or
our
yesterday
notes,
we talked about, yeah.
Crazy. I mean, like, they had a trip book. It's the itinerary. They fucking printed the itinerary for a cost of $100 each. 15 copies at $100 each. That's $1,500 for 15 agendas. Okay,
for their official trip book. And there were other expenses like the $3,825 overpayment for airport parking.
What were they parking? Where were they parking it?
His private jet. I don't know.
Okay. Yeah. So there, I think money has ended up in people's pockets that we are, I don't know, if to see if somebody actually tracks it down. But so far, the guy's hanging in there.
And then we have Pruitt. Yeah.
Pruitt, who is the head of the EPA, has been taking ridiculously expensive flights, even between New York and D.C. and then overseas. And I'm talking about like exponentially more expensive than you would just get like on Expedia or some shit. And when he was questioned about it, he said because when he sits in coach with the common people, he gets yelled at. Did somebody actually yell at him, like, fuck you, or say somebody said something to him?
The story is that someone came up to him in the airport and said, like, you're fucking up the environment.
He is?
I mean, that's a true statement, so... Mm-hmm.
Right. And so because of that, to save himself from the wrath of the commoners, he flies in first class. Luckily, we have people like John Cryer who said, okay, I'm going to find you there. I've made it to first class once in my life, so I'm not going to find him there, but hopefully John and others will. All right, that was our quick update on the taxpayer dollar drain.
Yeah, mass corruption among the cabinet is now like kind of a minor story we don't have time for.
Quick blip. All right. So the indictments, is that where we are?
Back to Mueller. And since we have to record today, we now have like multiple sets of indictments to discuss. Mm-hmm. In fact, we have three, well, there's, let's see, 16, 17, 18, 19 people since Friday in three different charging documents, I believe. But let's start chronologically. The first one to come was the Internet Research Agency indictments. On Friday, Mueller revealed the newest set of charges. Involved 13 individuals, all Russian nationals, and three organizations they worked under. And it described in a fair amount of detail how, starting in 2013 and then really kicked up in 2014, Russia enacted this plan to mess with American political institutions and in particular also to interfere with the 2016 elections, and did so through sort of disinfo and like social media manipulation. And, you know, basically carried out the campaign we saw online on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and who knows what elsewhere. And not just sort of, a lot of it was attacking Hillary. In fact, it details how one person in this group got in trouble because their posts weren't anti-Hillary enough. But also just to cause discord in general. They posed as like Black Lives Matter activists. They posed as, like you were saying, Muslim activists. And what are you saying about the voting?
Oh, yeah. I remember before the election, like, you know, this was, it was being circulated in the American Muslim kind of social media sphere that, you know, basically discouraging people from voting. They're like, don't vote because Hillary is a warmonger and she is responsible for the deaths of, you know, millions of Muslims in countries overseas and the war on terror and all that. And it was not only what this is being propagated, but it was actually being shared by like real life community leaders too. I remember, like, you know, some of the real lefty activists and stuff were like, yeah, we absolutely should not, you know, it's burning your bust. And then I mean there are some swing states and, like, you know, in which I do think that, like, in Michigan and stuff, there were enough American Muslim voters who probably, you know, cost Hillary that state. So it had an impact. And you know, I posted about this on my Facebook when this story came out on Friday, and when the indictment came out on Friday, and a lot of people commented and said, oh my God, I remember that. Oh my God, I remember people sharing this. I mean, people bought it. They believed it.
Yeah, and they encouraged people to vote for third parties like Jill Stein. Right. I think one of the actual lines was, make sure you attack all the candidates, but not Trump and Bernie. We support them. Mm. So, and there's a lot of great detailed analysis out there. Just Security and Lawfare have a lot of different takes that are worth looking at. But one thing in particular I wanted to focus on is just some of what we know now based on the details of the indictment. Now, obviously, this is not a complete document of what they know. They only put in the charging materials what they wanted to accomplish whatever strategic goals he's trying to do here. But the first high-level point of importance is what was actually charged. Now, most of the charges have to do with financial crimes. There were 6 counts of identity theft, and all this has to do with using sort of online payment methods to pay off people who were engaged in both the social media trolling and in in-person activism, appearing at rallies, making like a fake Hillary in a jail cell mural that they rode around in Florida in. I don't even know. But to do all this, they had to pay people. They had to give people money to arrange the rallies. So they used fake identities and PayPal and Bitcoin, but cryptocurrencies to do it, which is illegal in itself. So they have a lot of charges for that. There were also charges of bank fraud and wire fraud based on, again, these transactions to pay for the work they're doing. And only one of the counts was directly having to do with the broader conspiracy. It was the charge of conspiracy to defraud the government based on acts that involved trying to basically violate the law for, one, visas by lying about why they're coming to the country, like hiding their work history, hiding a purpose. 2, by trying to violate campaign finance laws by financing campaign-related expenditures in a way that can't be detected. And 3, through FARA violations, similar to how the Manafort and Gates were charged by acting as a foreign agent, but not reporting
Not registering. But to be clear, all these charges have been brought. I mean, nobody's going to be arrested for this. These people are not in the country. They're in Russia, we think, wherever. I mean, the point is, they're not. Nobody is in custody for these charges. So then the question is, what is this about then, like, more broadly?
It's about making sure they can't go on vacation ever again. Because they can't. If they ever go somewhere that's not like a third world place that hates America, they'll be arrested, right? And
they'll be extradited.
Brought here. And yeah. So we're only guessing now why Mueller is choosing to do this now in this order.
Mm-hmm. But there's an order here.
And what to me, I think, so what we know about this indictment is that before they announced it publicly, they briefed Trump on it. And Trump went away from that briefing thinking this was good news for him.
He's an idiot.
Well, yeah. But it seems very clear that was intentionally done.
It was, yeah.
To sort of like smooth it over. And they had, and Rosenstein was on board with this. He was clearly showing his skill as a survivor. You know, ethically ambiguous at times, a little bit weaselly, a little bit slick, but he's hanging in there and he's managing to secure his position as number 2.
But if you think about it, you know, they know who they're dealing with. They know exactly what this president is about, and they know how to get around him. If it was somebody a little bit sharper, he might see the forest for the trees. But this guy's an idiot. And so you know, they just were able to skirt right around him because he is just not bright enough. He's just not.
I think I put it yesterday, they are frog boiling the frog boiler. They are slowly easing Trump into this, you know, garden path of indictments, which is all heading towards his door. But he doesn't see it, doesn't realize it yet. And the longer he waits to act, the harder or more impossible it becomes for him to act.
Right. Because, I mean, we didn't mention this, but what happened after the indictments were announced was that Trump and then, you know, all the Trump surrogates were like, oh, yeah, this vindicates him because, you know, it's and it's almost like they didn't listen to the language. But, you know, Rosenstein said that in the indictment, no Americans have been basically, you know, connected to any kind of collusion or whatever. But that's in the indictment. I mean, it was a very limiting language, but Trump was like, I'm good. But I think at some point it dawned on him, and then he was stuck indoors because of the rain, and then he lost his mind over the weekend.
Apparently he watched news and saw that it was not actually a total win for him, and he became very sad.
Yeah. Trump tweeted 14 times over the weekend about this.
He just wouldn't stop, would he?
Yeah. Whether you're a busy professional, a parent on the go, or just looking for high-quality supplements, Aura Organic has the cleanest and most delicious nutritional products available.
If you go to a supermarket now and you walk down the aisles, you're going to see a lot of products that are claiming to be organic. Organic potato chips, vegan ice cream, sustainable cleaning products. But what about conscious nutritional supplements? That's where Aura Organic comes in.
And you know what? This is actually something I've never thought about because I buy plenty of nutritional supplements for me, for my kids. I get like protein powders, but I've never thought, how come I'm not getting this stuff in an organic form too? Well, now we can because Aura Organic provides it. And Aura offers a subscription service that's free to cancel or skip for all of their nutritional products. It's convenient. You get 20% off the products and no more running to the drugstore or the grocery store to grab some.
Their name, Aura Organic, comes from the New Zealand Maori greeting of Kia Ora, which literally translates as be well. And for Aura Organic, that means creating quality nutritional products that use sustainable sourcing and, of course, are actually tasty. Because if you enjoy the taste of supplements, you're probably more likely to use them.
I actually have used their organic pre-workout, the energy powder, and it is really delicious. So I have been a longtime user of different kinds of protein powders and energy powders and things like that, and adding them to my shakes and stuff. And Aura Organic has some great flavors. It's a really clean taste. It doesn't leave like an aftertaste in your mouth. It's good stuff. So try Aura Organic with 15% off your first order using the code 45th at www.aura.organic. Once again, that's www.aura.organic and use the code 45th to get 15% off your first order.
So again, what we know from the previous indictments, they all kind of hint at something that might be going on. It can be Trump-related, but they don't ever directly mention campaign activities. They sidestep any campaign involvement beyond what they had to put in there to get the plea deals through. And I think that's because Mueller knows exactly what he's up against. He knows that if he goes too directly, goes too hard, too fast, this will all blow up. He'll start pardoning people. He'll start firing Mueller. And what he has to do is to keep the investigation going long enough, get enough charges out there, get enough pleas out there, where this can't be stopped anymore. So let's go into the actual wording of the indictment. We do know now that there is significant visibility from Mueller's end into the financial operations of the Russian trolls. We know that they have a lot of details on not just the PayPal stuff, but on their banking transactions and how the money was doled out, how much money was being doled out. Apparently $1.25 million a month.
A lot of money.
During the election. And again, like...
And they had to hide all this money the way they were spending it, so... That's a lot of activity.
And it's important to sort of for me to separate the two issues about whether this activity, you cannot prove that this affected the election. And I don't think it matters. And it's also entirely separate from whether the behavior was criminal. There's a lot of people hung up on like, oh my God, if a bunch of trolls could change American democracy, then you're screwed already. Yeah, that's totally true and totally fair. But it's also not the point because we don't need to know what it did to,
right.
If it was like the but-for causation factor, because... This stuff is valuable for campaigns. It's expensive for campaigns, and they want it. So this was a contribution by Russia to the Trump campaign to help them accomplish their goals.
Did you read the Blake Housenell article? I think I saw you tweet about it that said...
Yeah, that annoyed the shit out of me.
That he's a little skeptical of whether there was collusion.
So I feel like this is where the divide is between reporters and lawyers. Because the reporters all seem to be like, oh, I'm skeptical of Russiagate because like these people just couldn't... And his argument was like, people in the campaign are too stupid to collude or do that. I'm like, motherfucker, have you ever seen a criminal conspiracy? They're all idiots. Like, the conspiracies are always way stupider and way less organized than you expect. Like, you start talking to people involved and, like, they start saying they don't know about stuff. And sometimes it's because they really don't have a clue what they're doing. They're not lying. They're just, it's not like a finely tuned machine by any measure.
And I feel like if you look at the Trump, I mean, like Trump and his family and the way they've operated over all these years, they have always operated like a bunch of idiots, but constantly doing things that are probably breaking the law.
Yeah, never assume the left hand knows what the right hand is doing, because they're both doing illegal things on their own often. And just because they're not communicating clearly about what they're trying to do doesn't mean they're both not doing illegal stuff.
Yeah, and just because they're a little bit stupid.
And this analogy, both hands belong to Trump, is just his little minions running around all trying to, like, you know, curry favor and whatever. So the fact that this is all stupid and obvious, that is not an argument that there was not a conspiracy.
It's not a defense. Lots of stupid criminals out there, yeah.
And second of all, aside from the criminal issues, criminal indictments, all that, the political scandal is proven, because what we know happened is that Russia was doing stuff to fuck with the election, to harm Hillary, and to help Trump win. Yeah. And they
defense would be this, and it's not really a defense, but is that they had planned to do this regardless of who they knew Hillary was going to be the Democratic forerunner, but whoever is going to be the Republican forerunner, I mean, they were going to disrupt the election one way or the other. They just got lucky that it was Trump and it was a guy already in their pockets.
That's not a defense that the guy that they decided to help ended up being okay with it and deciding to go, that was great. That's
not a defense, but I'm just saying.
It doesn't have to be planned from the beginning to be wrong and scary, because what happened is that Trump welcomed their interference, did not take action against it, and specifically stopped any actions that were designed to punish Russia for doing it. So that's a scandal. It's all in the open. We all know it. We've all known it for months. It's blatant and horrible and a grave threat to our democracy. And it's an entirely different question from whether it was criminal and whether it should be indicted.
Well, you know, Trump is finally admitting that it happened, which is one tiny step forward. He's probably like, well, I never said, you know, Russia didn't do it.
But he has been here before and he's gone back again. Like, there have been plenty of times he's like, and he's now his current, like, tweet kick is to accuse Obama of not taking enough action against this, which he's done before, like, on several different periods over the past 6, 7, 8 months.
And different issues, whether it's immigration, whether it's gun control. He's like, well, why didn't he do anything?
Or Russia collusion. And he'll now...
Dumb shit, you're president now.
I'm sure next Tuesday he'll come out and be like, I never said Russia interfered. They never meddled.
Yeah. Today he tweeted that he's tougher on Russia than Obama ever has been. Another defense that he's raised, and actually it's kind of tied to what I just said earlier, was he's like, well, I wasn't even going to run in 2024. He said a number of times, this began in 2014. I wasn't even planning to run. And that's a complete lie. He already was exploring the possibility. He had brought it up publicly many times. And so... that's also a lie. So maybe Russia was like, well, maybe this guy is going to put his hat in the ring and maybe he can help disrupt some stuff. But I'm positive Putin didn't think he'd get this far.
Have you seen the tweets from the Russian woman who was helping organize the 2013 Miss Universe in Moscow?
Oh, God, no.
She's now the ex-wife of, like, one of the little baby oligarchs and, like, the daughter of some other politician. I don't even know. I'm sure she's someone important in Russia, but I think all she's really known for... Most of the news about
the pageants.
That was kind of like a side thing she did. Most of the news about her is how she once, like, took pictures of her new kitten eating caviar and posted it on social media, and everyone got upset at her.
Okay.
Yeah, but she was also involved in setting up, you know, Miss Universe in Moscow, and her tweets are fascinating because during, like, this 2013, she has pictures posted of, like, her and Trump and comments like, we explained to him the importance of social media. And then, like, we look forward to you being president again.
What?
Yeah. Way early on.
Interesting. Okay.
And, like, she has a picture of him in some meeting and she's like, he won't shut up about how Obama sucks. Okay. So I'm not trying to suggest some, like, major conspiracy here, other than that Trump was obviously talking about his plan to run for president in 2013 in Moscow. And then there's a lot, her tweets are pretty bizarre. It's hard to know what to make of it, but a lot of it was, I mean, it shows on her end a fair amount of awareness of Trump's intention to run for president. And a lot to me, I shouldn't say this because this is pure speculation, I'll be irresponsible and say it. You look at the tweets and there are her friends suggesting that there's some kind of deeper relationship between her and Trump, as if, like, maybe he'd try to hit on her or something. So it seems like she has a history there.
I think he hits on anything that moves.
I know.
That's not exactly.
How dare I suggest that possibly Trump was, like, inappropriate with a young woman he was working with.
Yeah.
But her tweets also, like, talk about, like, how, like, after he won, it's like 3 years to the day. Oh, my gosh. How significant. We got this done. Or like, wow, she takes credit. People like congratulate her and her work at getting him elected.
I feel it's like weird. She needs to be subpoenaed for something.
Yeah. Something. So anyway, that's why Trump's claims that he was not running in 2014 are bullshit. The Russians unquestionably knew in 2013 he was running because he told everyone he possibly could. But we also know there's some parts of the indictment that I am fascinated by and I hope we learn more on. For instance, it alleges on June 4th, 2014 through June 26, 2014, two of the people charged in the indictment traveled in and around the United States, including stops in Nevada, California, New Mexico, Colorado, Illinois, Michigan, Louisiana, Texas, and New York to gather intelligence. That's it. Doesn't explain what intelligence they're getting or why they're getting it. I can't even think of something to speculate on here about what were they doing in 2014 in these states? What were they looking at? What could they have been looking at?
You know, I don't know enough about political organizing and this kind of stuff to know. I mean, I just thought maybe they're looking for people to work with on the ground and they're just, getting their ducks in a row for 2016.
But can you just imagine these two Russians showing up in Louisiana? Hi there. We would like to know about your political system. Can
we're
we help
here
you
for the gumbo.
Can we do any grassroots organizing for you?
Well, I mean, it's very specific language. Gathering intelligence, it's not, I mean, that means something a little more than just kind of checking shit out, right? I mean, it has to be a little more serious than that, I think. It's not a food tour they're on.
There's a reason it's in the indictment. It's part of the criminal conspiracy. It was definitely not a food tour. They have some way to prove it was part of the conspiracy, but we don't know what yet. And another similar paragraph from the indictment, it talks about how another co-conspirator who worked for the Internet Research Agency traveled to Atlanta, Georgia from approximately November 26, 2014 through November 30th, 2014. Following the trip, the co-conspirator provided another person indicted in the indictment a summary of his trip's itinerary and expenses. Now, this one's weird to me because it's so specific. They obviously have more information about why he was there. They don't include it. But what was a Russian doing as part of a conspiracy to undermine the U.S. political system in Atlanta in November 2014? The only guess I have right now is that on the 25th, we know that there were some significant protests in Atlanta regarding Ferguson. So that's the day before the Russian shows up in Atlanta. And that's it's kind of tenuous, but I can't think of anything else that might explain the trip and how this is all related. And we do know that after the Atlanta protest, a lot of Russian government officials and the media were making a big deal about the Ferguson protest and talking about how this shows America is not a democracy and this is just desserts for all their bad acts and basically trolling the U.S. over it, which suggests it was part of a coordinated messaging campaign.
I mean, I wonder if they were making these trips just to... Okay, they use bots and stuff to do a lot of the dissemination of the political stuff online. But even those bots have to be programmed to a certain extent. I wonder if they were doing these trips to just gather stuff on language, on just so it sounds more authentic. I don't know. I don't know what else they could be.
Well, we do know that they are apparently fairly naive, despite being a well-funded, relatively organization with a lot of experience in social media messaging. They didn't seem to have invested too heavily in someone on staff who actually knows American politics, because another part of the indictment says, for example, starting in or around June 2016, defendants and their co-conspirators posing online as U.S. persons communicated with a real U.S. person affiliated with a Texas-based grassroots organization. During the exchange, defendants and their co-conspirators learned from the real U.S. person that they should focus their activities on purple states like Colorado, Virginia, and Florida. After the exchange, defendants and their co-conspirators commonly referred to targeting purple states in directing their efforts.
That's pretty basic. But, I will say this. As somebody who's done work overseas, it's one thing to sit where you are. In the United States, I have access to a lot. I have access to a lot of news and information. It's not like I live in a country where I can't get access to a lot of stuff. But I still couldn't do my work without finding the local partners and local people. I had to make field trips to do the kind of work I was doing in those countries to first figure out what the hell is actually happening and talk to people on the ground. And so these could have been those kinds of things where, it's one thing to have the academic literature or read news, but it's another thing to go there and to really see it firsthand and ask people on the ground, exactly what are the issues, and hear it from them. How are they even presenting those things? So,
oh, purple states. That's very intriguing. Maybe we should look at purple states to try and focus our resources.
Well, but, they're like, that's what Americans talk. That's how Americans talk, you know? So now we're going to use that language.
So what it does show, and what I wonder, it's part of why Manafort included it in the indictment, is that despite all the money, despite all the troll factories and troll farms, whatever they have, little like trolling cubicles, whole operation on the Russian side would have benefited massively from some knowledgeable and targeted advice from someone with a strong background in American politics and knowledge of what the Trump campaign needed to accomplish.
Maybe nobody wanted to be that person.
Manafort raises his hand. Okay. Just guessing. I'm just saying it does show, though, that if someone in the Trump campaign had wittingly cooperated with the Russians, it would have been a massive benefit to both sides. The Russians could have absolutely improved the efficiency of their campaign. If there was something to be gained on both sides, and it could have very easily happened. I mean, if some grassroots organizer in Texas can help them out by telling them the purple states, imagine what Paul Manafort could have done if he was talking to these guys. And I remember that on a few different times, Hillary, or not herself necessarily, but Hillary is like people with their campaign, have made comments suggesting, who directed these efforts? The Russians couldn't have known where to target on their own, which to me suggests they have some more info that maybe someone, yes, was giving instructions about how to effectively harness the IRA's troll power. So we also know that there is a very sophisticated and in-depth counterintelligence operation going on, because the indictment quotes a lot of some emails from the troll factory workers, including one from 2017 where one of them writes to her family, or I assume she was late to some like grandma's birthday or something. It's like, sorry, slight crisis here at work. The FBI busted our activity. That's not a joke. So I got preoccupied with covering our tracks with my colleagues.
Jeez, what a thing to write in an email.
The Russians don't give a shit. That's what we've learned anything about this. It's the Russians don't give a shit at all. They're not trying to hide this.
This isn't the era of Trump. Like, Trump is president now, so maybe they really don't give a crap.
Yeah, I mean, obviously they care enough to try and, like, cover some of their tracks, but, I mean, it's remarkable. Like, even, not even just the IRA people, but, like, the fact that Manafort's partner, the Russian he works with a lot, was, like, using, like, his Gmail account to coordinate with Manafort, which, y'all know that the Americans can read that, right? I guess, I mean, maybe they don't, but they have to know that.
And I love what she wrote also in the same email. I created all these pictures and posts, and the Americans believe that it was written by their people. Thank you for spelling that out.
It is amazing, though. So, like, when you read, like, the quotes from the actual, like, Russian trolls that are posing as American, I guess not even trolls at that point, like, they're faking American activists to...
They're pretty bad at it, though.
But, like, they do have... They type with, like, a stereotypical, like, Russian grammatical accent. And, like, you read it in... I read it in my head.
I can hear it in my head. Yeah, you're right.
And, like, okay, sure, people write weird on the internet. But, like, at no point were you not like, this is a bit strange. Maybe we should question why this person wants to not meet, but pay me money to go, like, carry a sign calling for Hillary's imprisonment when they type like a Russian.
Like a Russian.
I don't even know what to call it. It's like a grammatical accent.
Yeah.
And that was not the only indictment that day. We also had a plea deal that came out with some guy in California who apparently had been arranging people banned from like PayPal to get PayPal accounts.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of him before.
I don't think he's a nobody. He's just some random. Probably didn't even know. I think there's no reason that he would have a clue he's working with Russians. Just people came to him and said, hey, I want a bank account with PayPal for undisclosed reasons that totally aren't not shady. And he's like, sure, man, gotcha. Gives him the account, helps him with identity theft, and that's it. Except this time he accidentally helped someone involved in a massive foreign relations domestic scandal and is now pled guilty to a felony for it. Backing up a little bit, over the weekend, we also learned from an LA Times article that apparently Rick Gates is on the verge of also entering to a plea deal. It hasn't happened yet. I guess we'll presumably know more. Rick Gates is the longtime business partner of Manafort. He's a bit younger, you know, has some kids, which I'm sure is influencing his eagerness to reach a deal that won't have him dying behind bars. It's unclear what he knows entirely. He did stay in the campaign after Manafort left. So he would have direct knowledge of campaign activities, like long after Manafort was no longer part of the picture or official part of the picture. But we also know that Trump apparently really disliked the guy. So he would not have been like a confidant. He might not have had, Who knows? But he knows everything that Manafort knows, pretty much, probably, which is going to be a lot. And if this is true, which it seems very fairly likely it is, Manafort's got a big problem. Because, like, Manafort's problem isn't Trump or the U.S. legal system. Like, Manafort's enemies are, they make having the president mad at you seem like child's play.
So, Susan, I have heard always that yoga is wonderful, wonderful for your health, for your mental well-being, for your flexibility, for longevity, and all kinds of stuff. But I have hated doing yoga when I've tried it. And you know why?
Because it sucks.
Because it's not easy to do. And I also, I don't like doing it in front of other people. When you are just starting out, especially, it's not pretty. It's not pretty.
I will say, I've probably never given yoga a fair try. My friends love it, and they try to drag me along a few times. And what always happens is they're there doing all the moves and stuff, and I'm sitting there flailing around like an octopus, not knowing what the hell I'm supposed to be doing. It's bad. It's ugly.
I did that too. I spent a lot of time being very self-conscious. And you know what? Now I don't have to, and you don't have to either, because Yoga Glow is an online yoga and meditation that you can do literally anywhere. They've got thousands of classes at all levels, so people like me can get started without feeling horrible.
So you're saying I can try yoga without everyone judging me?
And you won't even judge yourself.
So I can actually try yoga out.
Just don't do it in front of a mirror, maybe. But
definitely not doing that.
You should definitely try it out. I have gotten started on it, and I'm doing just a very elementary, because, you know, I don't want to push myself, don't want to hurt myself, but they've got amazing instructors like Catherine Budig, Elena Brower, and Jason Kandrill. And it's unlimited access for $18 a month.
And plus, I guess the benefit of yoga is that it's supposed to de-stress you, but just trying to go to classes and organize all that, that's stressful in itself.
Oh yeah, definitely. A lot of the battle is just getting there, you know? And this way, you just take it everywhere with you. It is so versatile. You can use it anywhere. You have a connected device, and you can catch a class. You can catch a live class. You can catch classes that are recorded.
All right, you convinced me. I will try it. I will probably not tell you how it went, but I will try it.
All right, well, let us know how it goes. And for our listeners with Yoga Glow, you can practice again in your own space, on your own time, for just $18 a month. That's actually less than one single class at a yoga studio. So get your first 2 weeks of Yoga Glow for free when you sign up on yogaglow.com/45th. That's yogaglow, GLO.com/45th, for 2 entire weeks for free. yogaglow.com/45th. So today, so this is like the bonus information we've gotten, having postponed our episode drop by a day, is that apparently an attorney with a very well-known law firm here, Skadden Arps, I mean, this is like a, it's kind of shocking, I think, in the legal community that an attorney with Skadden Arps would be charged with something like this, but...
Especially Skadden. Like, Skadden's like one of the most hoity-toityest like law firm there is.
Very, very hoity-toity.
They are the hoitiest of the toitiest.
I did some contract work with them a long time ago, but yeah, they're very fancy. I think they do a lot of work on campaign finance. They're very, very well paid, but they're like, you know, it's a real white glove firm.
So the whole story starts back in Ukraine in 2012 is when Skadden gets on board. So we know Manafort was over there helping. I'm going to pronounce it wrong. You can send me angry emails. I apologize in advance.
Timoshenko?
No, Yanukovych. See, okay. Every time I say this, people like email me and say, you did it wrong. And then I overthink it when I try and say it again. So
just go with your gut. Go with your gut, Susan.
Yanukovych. Goddamn, now that's all I can think about. That's okay.
It's fine.
Anyway, so when Manafort was over there helping the then president win, there was a slight issue after the election. His rival, Timoshenko, he wanted to lock her up. So he did lock her up and accused her of corruption and all sorts of stuff. And then suddenly Skadden Arps gets involved doing an intensive research project to evaluate whether or not this was legitimate, that whether the Ukrainian president's decision to imprison his political rival was, you know, possibly corrupt and dangerous and undemocratic. And so Manafort gets Skadden involved. Skadden claims to have won a $12,000 bid for this project, which is coincidentally just under the amount the cutoff for when you need to have bids. So for a no bid contract award in Ukraine, it's like max 12K. That's what they decided to pay Skadden for this. Only, of course, there was like $1 million that transferred hands, which is a lot more than 12K. And the report itself was extremely irresponsible and gross and embarrassing. And everyone involved should be ashamed of themselves, because I mean, yes, if you're an attorney, you do, your goal is to help your client, but there is nothing that makes it okay to write a report that essentially signs off on theoretically democratic leaders' vast abuse of power in this way. They didn't have the resources to understand what was going on. Like, they were brought in to paper over an obvious abuse of power. They weren't there to actually give a real report, but they pretended they were, and got paid lots for it, and then lied about how they were getting paid.
So this report was written for who, though? This is what I was confused about. Who was this report written for? Who was the audience?
Yanukovych. It was for the international audience.
The just goal for the was international convince, audience.
Okay, yeah, the goal is to convince the world that it was okay that he had locked up his political rival.
Okay. Well, but so that itself, though, was not illegal for them to do, right?
It may have been, because there was, again, the payment issue. So they got problems there. But fast forward a while, we know that Ukraine's been trying to take action here for a bit. And we know last year they actually got $500,000 back from Skadden for it. And then in November 2017, Mueller started sending out requests based on this. And what we now know is that there is probably at this exact moment, a guy named Alex van der Zwaan is in court pleading guilty to one count making false statements to the FBI. Because this dude's got no excuse. He's an attorney, apparently sophisticated, should have known goddamn well not to talk to the FBI without massive, massive preparation, his own attorney, and to definitely not lie when he did it. Oh my God, what an idiot.
Yeah.
So we don't know the details of that, but here's what we do know. On November 3rd, 2017, FBI talked to him, and he told at least two lies. And we know that the FBI was asking him about his work as an attorney at Skadden, who was engaged by the Ukraine Ministry of Justice, supposedly, to prepare the report on Tymoshenko's trial and arrest. And he lied first about his last communication with Richard Gates and said it was in mid-August 2016 and that it was just innocuous text messages. And he said that his last communication with Person A, we don't know who that is, was in 2014 when they discussed Person A's family. And he also lied that he did not know why an email between him and Person A in September 2016 was not produced to the special counsel's office. When, in fact, he was there, he then and there well knew and believed, one, that in September 2016, he spoke with both Gates and Person A about the Tymoshenko report and recorded those calls.
That's interesting. Yeah,
I know. And two, he deleted or somehow lost the emails that Mueller was seeking between him and the law firm, including the email between Person A and him in September 2016, which to me says that this guy is an idiot and not Skadden wouldn't actually produce stuff when Skadden knew that, it was time to come clean and actually produce the goods. You are now looking at being the client, not the attorney. So my guess is Skadden was like, okay, look, let's stop fucking around with this. Give them the goddamn emails. And poor little van der Zwaan sitting there like, oh yeah, we got this conspiracy under control. I'm not going to produce the emails I got because I know Skadden's not going to do it. Yeah, sucks to be you, dude. And the recording calls thing, I don't know. I have no idea what that's about.
Why? Why would he do that?
It's probably not this, but part of me wonders is lawyerly instincts. As an attorney, I document everything. I'd like to have just it's kind of force of habit because you never
you want a paper trail.
It's just a force of habit. In litigation, you always want to document opposing calls with calls opposing counsel just so you have a record somewhere, even if you never use it. And I wonder if just force of habit made him do it. And he created a paper trail where he should not have done so. That's probably not it. He probably had some reason in mind, but I'm really curious to find out what that was.
Let me ask you a little bit. I forgot to ask you this question when we were talking about the indictments themselves. I know you've moved on, but I want to ask you this. Because this is probably not going to go anywhere in terms of, an actual prosecutions. Do you think we're ever going to get details on what exactly Mueller's team knows about these trips and some of the other, gathering intelligence? Are we ever going to find that information ever out?
I hope so. I know Adam Schiff was saying one of his concerns is that Mueller's findings won't be made public. If there are trials, we'll find out the government's case in those trials. If there are pleas, we might not ever find the evidence behind them. And for stuff that might affect ongoing intelligence operations, we may never, ever hear about. But I hope, and there are always big, big costs to making stuff public. There's a cost to making this indictment public. Yeah. But I think that we have reached special circumstances where the only option we have is to disinfect all of it and accept the consequences of doing so by making what can be made public, public.
All right. So this current plea that we think is taking place as we record, getting back to that quickly, what do you think the relationship here is to, I mean, it is connected, right? Like, this is all part of kind of the same. Is it connected? Is it not connected? I mean, we know Manafort's heavily involved with Ukraine and Russia. And I mean, just trying to figure it out.
Theoretically, it's about the Ukraine work and the existing charges against Manafort.
Right.
But coincidentally, Alex Van der Zwan is the son-in-law of German Khan, the Russian oligarch, who is also involved with Alpha Bank, which was implicated as well in 2016 election. What does it mean? I don't know. At this point, like, especially with this kind of high-level like Russian oligarch stuff, they're all connected everywhere. They all got ties.
That's the problem. It's so incestual, right?
Yeah. Like, so the connections are definitely there.
Susan, I'm going to buy you a chalkboard so you can make one of those Glenn Beck chalkboard networks.
Yeah, not with the Russian oligarch stuff, because like literally it'd just be like like blacked out with lines everywhere. So who knows if it's significant. But again, I think there's a reason this was important enough to get a plea deal out of. There's a reason that they're trying to get leverage out of this guy. And Mueller's strategy does seem to be to focus all around the periphery of the election without actually overtly stating that's what's related to. And this could be another example of that.
Awesome. Sounds good. All right. Is that it for this week then?
That is it for the 45th 45th.
All right. Well, that was a lot going on. I feel like every day we're going to get like new indictments and pleas. And I just feel like the wheels are turning faster now and it's exciting.
Closer Mueller gets, the faster he has to go.
That's right. That's right. That's right. All right. Thanks so much, listeners, to the 45th. We will be back in 7 days. Have a good week.
6 days, actually.
We'll be back in 6 days. Have a good week. A big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible. And I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products. And thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan. We have been produced by Long Arc Digital Media, and you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is @45thpod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. And guess what? You can even leave us a voice message. Call us at 202-670-8345, and you never know, we might just play your message on the air. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.